Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So it's my pleasure today to be joined on the G word with Sally Davies, the Chief Medical Officer for England, formerly, now the Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, the UK's Special Envoy on Antimicrobial Resistance, and various other accolades and achievements, too numerous to mention in a brief podcast. Sally, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here, I think.
No, I'm not. I promise, though, it's not going to be a hostile grilling. No, it's all good. Sally, as Chief Medical Officer, you published this iconic report, Generation Genome, in 2016. I want to come to that, but I'd love to understand first, just give us a bit of context about how you got into genomics and how you got to be the Chief Medical Officer for the country.
I got into genomics because my mother gave me the double helix when I was 15. And I thought it was so amazing that I applied to medical school. That's what I said in all the interviews when I got offers. And then having done medical school, I was a bit of an oddity because not everyone got genes. I eventually, after various forays into things, decided I was particularly interested in sickle cell disease, which is, of course, the paradigm molecular disease. And I spent more than 20 years working with a very big clinic of patients and wonderful people in Northwest London with sickle cell disease, developing screening programs for them, prenatal diagnosis, and everything. And so I kind of cut my teeth by being on the front line with patients who had genetic disease and all those issues.
And Sally, just sort of pretend that I'm a smart, 13 or 14-year-old, and just explain to me, why is sickle cell such a paradigmatic kind of disease that we understand because of DNA?
The problem with sickle cell is that because you've inherited a gene, which is the controlling element of what cells make, from each of your parents for sickle, you make the protein in red blood cells differently from people who haven't got it. That is to say that the red substance that makes the blood red, when it gives up its oxygen, because the purpose is taking oxygen from the lungs to tissues, instead of staying in a nice liquid, makes crystals. And the crystals are stiff. And imagine a red blood cell that's stiff. It can't squeeze through the tiny blood vessels. So it's a bit like a heart attack. You get a blockage in a small blood vessel, and that gives you pain. And usually, for most, flow begins again, and the pain goes away, but you might get some scarring. And of course, there are occasions when it doesn't settle, and you'll get real tissue necrosis, or it can be overwhelming, and you get death. The tragedy for sickle is that we know some things that help make the sickling happen less and give fewer problems. But however well you behave, there is that risk that something will go wrong and you'll get sickling and an acute pain crisis, or the sickling in an area of the body that really matters.
Got it. And so through those experiences of working with patients who just have one little change in their DNA, and that flows through how that DNA then encodes RNA, which makes proteins, which carry the blood through the oxygen through the blood around the body. I guess that must have been a pretty visceral experience of seeing the impact of how changes in the gene flow through to humans. Did those experiences on the front line
teach you also about how we can start to address some of these issues, or give you any sort of reflections on how to actually bring these insights to patients, to doctors?
Well, it taught me the importance of listening to patients and talking to patients. After all, we're beginning to get some moderately effective treatments, but still, it can be, even in a rich country like ours, an horrific experience, and the average life expectancy isn't the same as yours or mine. And I had to learn how to describe the genetics to people, because, you know, not only is the how do you live with it and how do you look after your child with it, there is inevitably the mums always felt guilty. And so you had to explain it wasn't their fault and this is how it had happened, and that actually it takes two to tango. The father would give one gene and the mother one gene. But explaining all of this and going through it very carefully in a sensitive way and repeatedly, because you can't take it all in once. And I understood how to get it right. You have to listen, you have to talk, and we learn from our patients. My patients were wonderful. I still am in contact with some of them. They're fantastic people.
And it's such a deeply human thing that you mentioned there around this feeling of guilt. How do you think that understanding genetics and genomics can help people process this crazy mix of emotions about our health and our kids' health and inheritance and so on?
Some parents will never get rid of the guilt. Now, that must be their psychological makeup. But to help parents understand that they didn't make the gene, they were just unlucky that they came together in their child, and that their parents had it and the parents before. And that actually being a carrier had an advantage if you were in a falciparum malaria area in that first year of life. So beginning to explain why the mutation happened by chance on a number of occasions, we know that, different occasions, but it stayed because it gave this advantage to the baby in that first year of life. So this wasn't, you know, just some horrible thing visited on humanity. Even today in Nigeria and Ghana and places, what you get is the balance of the good in that first year of life against the bad of having the patients who get the gene from both parents. I'm trying to help them understand all of that so they can see that it isn't their fault. It is something they carry and they have to live with, but not their fault.
So sickle cell anemia is, as you say, a really clean example of how fundamental research, in this case, research that led to Nobel Prizes and other situations, then can get translated into a much richer understanding of the human body, how people present in hospital and how they live their lives, how they manage with this condition. If we come back to Generation Genome and the thinking at that point in 2016, how do we take an example like sickle cell and think about applying that to a whole healthcare system? Why did it feel like that was the time to go big? I guess Generation Genome is a very ambitious title, right?
Yes. It was thought up by the teenage daughter of one of my colleagues. And I liked it, which is why I used it. What I brought from the sickle world into my time, both as the Director General of Research running NIHR and then as Chief Medical Officer, was this knowledge of how difficult it was to live with an inherited disease. First, to get the diagnosis, that diagnostic odyssey. You'd think that sickle was easy enough. I could have introduced you in the day to a number of mums who were investigated for non-accidental injury because their children had swollen hands or swollen feet. It was a feature of the disease, but The doctors who looked after them didn't know it. So I had, you know, kind of internalized the diagnostic odyssey, the horrors of that, as well as what it was like to live with it. And what I learned was that whatever the diagnosis, people generally find it much easier to have a diagnosis. And sometimes it can lead to better outcomes. So whether it's prenatal diagnosis or, as we know from the 100,000 genomes, some treatments for these children. And that, after all, has to be our dream. And everyone knows now about the 100,000 project. And I think that's fantastic. And I'm glad that it's still going forward, the same, looking at children with rare diseases and working about it. But what we needed to do was say, so we've got lots of learning from single gene disorders. We've got lots of learning now about the fact you can do whole genomes and you can up your diagnostic rate and you can introduce new treatments and find ways. But actually, this has to be part of a normal service. We've got to stop children having that diagnostic odyssey round the system. We need to make this part of our service. And I think the NHS have been fantastic how they've embraced it. In the NHS, we find it difficult to change, but actually we've managed to make this change. So that's one side. And then the other side is, how do you use genomics for cancer? And I was horrified. I still remember a patient writing to me a year before the Generation Genome saying, I've got a lung cancer and it's been sequenced and the pathway that's impacted, the biochemical pathway is, and she told me, there is a drug for that pathway, but it's used in pancreatic cancer. They won't pay for me to have it because they say I've got lung cancer and it's not allowed. And I thought, this is bonkers. We've got to move to molecular diagnoses and then think about what the molecular diagnosis means and how do we do it. And I also, as part of writing these reports, I would bring in all the experts and talk to them. And then I sent them away to write their chapters. Then they would come back and help me think through what are the policy implications. And remember the one who said, look, we now can tell, and we can do polygenic risk scores and tell which women are most likely to get cancer and at what levels. And frankly, we could do a much better service by the women in this country if we stopped screening the ones who are almost unlikely to get breast cancer, but really put a big effort into getting hold of screening and supporting the women who are really likely. And I began to see that we could change our services to cost no more, but to give much better services to the public. And that's, after all, what we need to be doing. So I think there's what do we learn, there's how do we help individual patients and their families, but then there's how do we deliver better services. And that's what Generation Genome was all about. And also trying to get people to think about what does this mean and how do you get the patient and the public center stage to be part of moving this forward, because actually that makes it happen much better.
And it's an incredible scale, right, to do this on a national scale. And we have the Genomic Medicine Service in England and the UK. We're on the verge of launching a whole genome sequencing diagnostics as part of that at a health service scale. Whereas, as far as I understand, there's a couple of the high-end hospitals in America that do this at a hospital scale, but no other health systems. You talked about the difficulty of changing systems as large and complex as the NHS. What does it take to do that? And what can we learn from the experience of introducing genomics into the NHS that's relevant to other, I guess, advanced technologies or treatments?
So I think I played it out when I set up the National Institute for Health Research, NIHR, and we've played it out for genomics. And the lessons are very similar. You've got to have an inspirational vision that is based on good science and evidence, because you've got to sell it to the people who are going to feel the change. But then you do have to have some money to pay for, whether it's the double running or the change management or the development of people. You can't do this massive sort of change of NIHR, genomics into the health service, without putting some money into the people who have to do it, as well as the kit and all of that. But you can do it. And you need inspirational people. And it's not just one, you need a number of them talking about it and showing the people in the system what they can do. And of course, patient power is particularly powerful. That's why the rare diseases are so very good at this. They know how to mobilize.
Yeah, and it's we're as humans, we're so kind of addicted to stories, aren't we? I'm already just reflecting back on the story you told a second ago about mums of kids with sickle cell who had swollen hands or feet and who were therefore kind of wrongly accused of having, you know, harmed their own children. It's such a visceral story. And I think that unless we're careful, we can lose some of those human stories as we start looking at Gantt charts and process plans and, you know, financial forecasts and so on. How do you think we can get better at telling some of those stories while still kind of moving with the operations and the logistics and so on?
Well, I mean, a lot of people find it very difficult to tell those stories, but you only need a few who are telling them loud enough and bring the patients in to tell their own stories. Over the years, people have said, you can't say that, it's an N of one rather than the randomized controlled trial. To which my response is, I can say that because it shifts the mountains that allows you to do the randomized controlled trial or you to access genomics for your patients. Come on, what we're doing is explaining what we need or what we're doing in a way that people can buy into the vision and help make it happen.
Absolutely. So we've talked a bit about sick kids, I guess, and particularly with the rare disease community, that's often where these conditions are picked up. There is a discussion at the moment of doing whole genome sequencing for newborns, for newborn babies, and using that to diagnose whether they have one of a number of conditions that that are sort of treatable and that people could do something about, effectively building on the heel prick test that happens at the moment. That's something which generates very strong emotion and response from lots of people. What do you think are the potential benefits of that that kind of approach of sequencing new kids at birth? And what kind of considerations should we, as I guess the genomics community, think through as we're trying to figure out how best to try and realize some of those benefits?
Well, I think it's an extraordinary, exciting thing to do because a lot of people think you shouldn't do the genomes of babies because they can't consent and what will people do with all the information? But we know that already the way that the heel prick is used in neonatal screening, there's a mass of information that people don't look at and they don't act on. So there's no change there. There's no difference in that ethics. The ethics are, what have we agreed as a nation that we will look for? And there are different ways of looking for it. So then why would you change? Well, first of all, because it's quite laborious how it's done at the moment. And I think you could make it much easier because you can get DNA out of a heel prick onto blotting paper perfectly well. But secondly, there are other things we could get and we could give to the families. And I'm thinking of pharmacogenomics. We could give them a readout that went on their medical record saying, if ever you need this antibiotic or this drug or that drug, you need a very little dose because otherwise it'll damage you, or you need a double dose in order to have an effect. So there is good information that could just be pulled out at no cost at all, automatically. Meanwhile, we would learn so much more about how to look after people. But how are we going to make it happen? We need, again, the patients, the families, all to say, yeah, as long as you're ethical and you're not looking for things that we haven't agreed as a nation, then where's the problem?
Yeah. I guess it's a very intimate data set, right? It's like we talk about, you know, de-identification and so on for research purposes. The analogy I sometimes think of is it's a bit like your fingerprint. If you put your fingerprint on a piece of paper and just tear off the bit at the top that has your name on it, it's still your fingerprint. How can we think about that almost kind of value exchange? So let me ramble for a second and see if you think this is a fair analogy. I was thinking about this recently, and I'm a big user of Spotify and music services, and there's a data exchange going on there. So Spotify understands all the music I listen to, and in exchange, they offer me recommendations, which I quite like. I think their recommendations are pretty good of new music that I might like. on a very grand scale, to some extent, we're talking about the same kind of value exchange. We're talking about some the parents of a baby, or as that person grows up, the person themselves trusting the NHS with that data. And in exchange, we get something much more profound than here's a new song you might like. We get, as you say, potentially life-saving information about how we might respond to drugs, predictive information about whether we might need to be early screened for X or Y. And the pitch, I think, is quite extraordinary to say, congratulations, if you're a citizen, you get a free lifelong subscription to this this service. Is it as simple as framing it in those terms, or is that overly kind of Silicon Valley utopian?
I think it's a bit much for some people, but it's not that I disagree. I think the problem is genetic exceptionalism. That people think because it's genomics, it should be treated quite differently. But the tests that go on, I know I did a lot around neonatal screening. I'm actually quite expert at this. I give you signatures that tell you what about your parents. We were talking about sickle cell disease. I've never forgotten the man patient coming to see me and saying, so what's my baby got? Well, you'd have expected the baby to be a sickle cell carrier, and it wasn't. We are quite used to this, and it's in our system already. High performance liquid chromatography gives you signatures that you could track back. So stop the genetic exceptionalism. What we're talking about is changing techniques and the advantages to the patient, because we're not going to do anything to it that hasn't been agreed ethically by our system, the National Screening Committee or whatever. And then how do we preserve, I don't say any longer, and I'll come back to why, their confidentiality. How do we preserve their privacy? Let's be honest about it. It's privacy. There are extraordinary ways. I've got a very big project going, which you probably know about, the Trinity Challenge, and we're working with the top of Microsoft and Google and Facebook and everything. And they talk about privacy, but they show me their latest and how they can maintain privacy. You look at what Palantir does. They, presumably, if they looked at their data, could tell you where most Secret Service agents are for the West in dreadful countries. But it's the privacy is preserved. We can do it. So we need to move on and get rid of genomic exceptionalism and talk about privacy and what we've agreed we're going to do.
Absolutely. Compelling vision. So 2016, Generation Genome, you know, bringing these insights from the lab into the mainstream of healthcare, and in a really inspiring way, we're seeing a lot of that play out today. Here we are in 2021. And genetics and genomics and sequencing is suddenly on everyone's lips in a way that has never been before. The UK has contributed over half of the viral sequencing globally. We've got human genome sequencing to try and understand the drivers of severity of response and so on. We're standing up testing and sequencing labs around the country in a way that's never been done before at this incredibly rapid pace. With all of this infrastructure that we're laying down in response to the pandemic, if you looked into a crystal ball and saw a sort of happy path, maybe over the next 5 years, you know, we're now 5 years on from Generation Genome, 2026 will be 5 years on from now. With our increased infrastructure and our increased understanding of what genomics and genetics can teach us, what do you think we could be doing in 5 years' time?
Let's start with the lesson from HIV. When HIV started and we could test for it, you had to go to a special clinic, be counseled, and all the rest of it. Now it's a routine test. And you say to the patient, by the way, I think I should do an HIV test for the following reason, okay? And it happens. I think that in 5 years' time, we will have genomics embedded. And my dream is that even surgeons will say, oh, and I'm running a genomic test for this. And it will just be routine. That will stretch us, because you can't expect the surgeons and everyone to have the interpretations that we're going to have back in the labs, people who understand what different mutations mean based on the evidence at the time, and actually possibly a go back again system so that, you know, every couple of years, you have a look and see if it's changed. But that would be part of my dream, so that you get someone with a high cholesterol. If it doesn't look as if it's DART, you do look at their genome. You get someone with hypertension. You do look and say, doesn't matter if you eat salt. Oh, don't eat salt. That'll be the end of you. You know, and you start to, because at the moment, all people with high blood pressure have to be treated the same. Yet there's a significant number who don't have to be. So we'll begin to use it like that. But I think the final thing I'd say is, I hope we will use it for infectious diseases and do a lot more. Because what we know is, not only have we got the problem of COVID and lots of infectious diseases, we've got the rise of those infections developing resistance to antibiotics and other anti-infectives, which I call AMR, and we really need genomic signatures doing to show what bug it is, what the resistance is, what antibiotic to use. But we also know that in us and on us, we have our microbiome, which is more cells, bacterial, viral, and everything, than the number of human cells we have. And they're our friends. They're like a garden. We've got to plant them properly. And we need to be starting to look at those much more. And genomics is going to play a key role. And it will play a key role because we now know that if your garden of your microbiome in your gut is wrong, you're more prone to inflammatory disorders, to depression, to Parkinson's, to obesity. It's linked to diseases as well as carrying antibiotic resistance. And genomics is going to play a big role in that. And then the last thing I'll pick out is that we should be using genomics much more for surveillance of what's going on. So there's some people looking at poo in sewage and looking for antibiotic resistance genes to see what's going on and monitor it. There's a very nice few projects looking at COVID in sewage. And the level and volume or concentration of COVID gives you a feel for how much is in the community. And in fact, a kind of peak upwards comes a week before clinical symptoms and 3 weeks before deaths. So it's a very good way of having an early warning signal. So it's going to come into diagnostics in that sort of way too. So lots to do, and we better do it all, because otherwise we as humanity will be failing.
There you go. That's a good set of marching orders. I guess it's a positive vision of how embedding genomics in all of these different areas can actually answer questions for us as humans, or kind of solve problems for us in a way that that we couldn't do before.
Yes. I mean, I could go on for hours, as you probably know, about other things like CRISPR and how we could engineer trees, for instance, so that they're protected from infections, so we don't have to use antibiotics on the citrus crops in Florida. Or we could save the olive trees of Tuscany and Umbria, who have got a bacterial infection. There are so many things that genomics and our technologies will help us with.
Well, Sally, you've just opened the door to me saying, well, we're going to have to come back and do another podcast later on in the year. But in the meantime, thank you so much for your time today. And thanks for painting that that vision of a genomically enhanced future for us.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.